Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. The opportunity to get out and explore Vermont's many arts and cultural events has returned, and one will happen next week. It's called Ten Fest, and it goes on next Thursday through Sunday at Valley Players in Waitsfield. It's put on by a group called the Vermont Playwrights Circle. We're going to learn about the group and about Ten Fest as we're joined now by the founder and vice president of the Vermont Playwrights Circle, Kim Ward. Kim, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks.
You're welcome. And we're also joined by the founder of Ten Fest, playwright Jeannie Beckwith. Jeannie, great to have you here as well.
Great to be here.
Thanks for being. All right, listeners, if you want to ask our guests about Playwright Circle or about Ten Fest, you can call us 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Kim, what is the Vermont Playwrights Circle?
Vermont Playwrights Circle is a loose group of people who get together to support each other creating original theater works in Vermont.
And does Vermont have a large community of playwrights?
We really do. If I were to quote Jeannie, I'd say you can't throw a rock without hitting a playwright in Vermont.
Well, we don't want to harm them, so don't be throwing any rocks. Jeannie, how does having a group like this help individual playwrights?
Well, it's wonderful that, first of all, it's a supportive community of people who are doing some of the same things you are. We have the workshop that meets once a month, sometimes more often. And you can bring, say you've got 20 pages of script and you want to hear it, because most of these playwrights are also very good actors. And so the group meets and you can bring new material. It's also, it's a venue for talking about, getting your plays done, where to go. It's a support group.
Yeah. What kind of support do you get when you're part of that group, Jeannie?
Well, you get feedback on individual scripts, which you can take or not take.
Mm-hmm.
But also, say, I see that there's a call for plays, and it may not be for something I have something ready to go for, but I will contact. I say, oh, that's something Kim would be interested in, or Deborah Zipkin, or one of the other playwrights, Mary Beth McNulty, and we just And I think everyone does that for me, too. I mean, we just keep our eyes open. There are opportunities all around this country, but there are also thousands of playwrights.
Mm.
So you've got to be on top of things.
Kim, I know you're based out of Montpelier, but are the playwrights from all around the state?
They are. I'm a native Vermonter, as much as a white person can be. What I decided when we founded the group is that we would really honor people who are either living here or have lived here. So we have people who currently live in Vermont. We have people who live in New England and even further afield who are involved.
When and how did the Playwright Circle get started, Kim?
Many years ago, almost 22 years ago, I graduated from Goddard with a master's in performance poetry. And I had a bit of my thesis, which was called Angel in the Fire, performed in the Vermont Playwright Showcase. And it was somewhere around 98 or 2000. And when I did it, I was very excited, except the director of that showcase said, you know, we're going to be discontinuing this. We don't have the people to do it anymore. And so I immediately said, well, we need something to continue, and began doing summer readings at Lost Nation Theater on their dark nights to sort of replace that showcase.
And how has the circle changed or grown through these years?
Yeah, we started off with Jeannie and I and Roger Strauss, who's also a local filmmaker. He was involved in that film called Made in Vermont. I think he was one of the writers. It was just three of us, and now I would say we have a regular core group of playwrights that's probably 15 playwrights. We've done, this will be our 13th year of 10 Fest. And every year you're talking 10 new plays by 10 authors. So it's really expanded from there to be a great network.
Jeannie, we'll get to 10 Fest, but what opportunities are there for the state's playwrights to have their plays produced?
Well, I'm trying to keep track of them. Right now, it's, of course, with the pandemic, with COVID, everyone seems to have been on hold. But you've got the Off Center in Burlington. You have the Parish Players. You have in Rutland, the Actors Repertory Theater, Old Church Theater, and Monica Callan's Moxie Productions. And I could go on because there are places down in the southern part of the state that pop up from time to time.
And what theater groups have performed some of your plays, Jeannie?
Well, all of those I've just mentioned. plus, you know, I've had plays done around the country, too. And
I think internationally.
Yes, I've had this past year, I had plays in London, and I've had plays in Dublin and Istanbul.
Wow. Kim, how about you? Where have what theater groups around the state have performed some of your plays?
I used to live up north, and so Fairfax Community Theater has done some stuff of mine before. And also, mostly what I have been doing is informal readings and such. I think I'm a slower burn when it comes to producing my own work. Moxie Productions did do a play of mine 1 year, which was really great.
And then, Kim, what are some of the activities and events that the Vermont Playwrights Circle hosts?
So we host a monthly workshop, which is the third Tuesday of every month. We've been doing that over Zoom straight through the pandemic, but we used to do it live, and we hope to do that again. We also have a newsletter in which we put out calls for plays, as well as news about anyone locally who's performing local playwrights' work. So it might not be something we're doing, but for instance, you know, Lost Nation Theater did a production of Jeannie's piece, Love Letters Made Easy. We made sure to put that in there. And then the 10 Fest production is really the big, sort of more grand performance that we do.
And we're going to, I promise we're going to get to that. We'll wait till after the break. But I want to ask you about something you brought up, Kim. Your major at Goddard was performance poetry. And I'm not sure I know exactly what that is. So I'd love for you to explain to us what performance poetry is.
Sure. I was really influenced when I was an undergraduate at Johnson State. I was a dance minor, a writing major, and spent the rest of my time in theater. And there were a lot of dance companies performing spoken word through the 70s and 80s. And I was really fascinated by that because I started out as a poet. And so when I went to Goddard, I decided I was going to write a full-length poetic play. Some people might have heard of Tezaka Shange, who wrote for Colored Girls, who considered suicide when the rainbow is enough. And that is a poetic, you know, theater piece, many monologues of poetry and choral pieces. And so that's sort of where I focused my work. So I knew I wanted to continue poetry and put it on stage.
Wow. Jeannie, you're the founder of 10 Fest. First of all, explain what 10 Fest is.
10 Fest is an evening of 10 minute plays. And it's a festival. The 10 minute play is an interesting format. It is, you have to have a beginning, a middle, and an end. It's a full story. It's not like a Saturday Night Live sketch.
Right.
But it has to be complete in itself. And several years ago, before 10 Fest, I got the idea down at the Parish Players, had a 10-minute play, a short play festival. They were, some of the plays were shorter than 10, some were longer, but it just seemed like such a good format. And then the Boston Theater Marathon is an annual event for 10-minute plays, and I had a play accepted down there. And it just seemed like it was an opportunity for us to do, we've done staged readings with the Playwright Circle. We were talking about doing something that was more of a production. And so we thought, and she calls me the founder, but Kim was right. We just said, well, let's try and do this. Let's do it. And we did it. We traveled and we went from various places around central Vermont to try and find a venue. And we ended up, the Valley Players have been so good to us. They have given us a home and support. And we have, it's a great location and it's a great setup for us. I'm babbling here.
No, you're doing just fine. Jeannie, if somebody is on for 10 minutes and 30 seconds or 11 minutes, do you shoo them off the stage before they can finish the play, or what happens?
Well, no, and that was actually in the beginning something. We have worked to try and keep all the plays to 10 minutes, and you would be surprised at how much material a sneaky playwright such as myself can cram into 10 pages. And we've gotten much better at that. There have been times when plays, well, you went 20 minutes, 20, well, when you have the stage directions, you have to take those into consideration, because we had a play once which was a wonderful play, and the action went backwards in time. But in order to maneuver through that, yeah, there was probably only 10 minutes of dialogue. But, excuse me, there was easily another 10 minutes of movement on the stage.
All right. So 10 being kind of just a vague suggestion. Kim, how are the 10 plays chosen for 10 Fest?
Yeah, we actually put out a call every year, beginning of the year. And then we ask a few of our, you know, friends in theater to serve as judges, and they read them anonymously. So they read them. We have a little bit of a grid we give them. Is the plot good? Are there full characters, et cetera? You know, does it fit into the 10-minute format? And then we rank them, and the top 10 are what we do.
And what is this year's theme, Kim?
This year's theme is a holdover. It is called, our initial theme was Hindsight is 2020, and we have changed it because we had to hold all of the plays because of COVID, and they're being performed a year late. We're calling it Hindsight Was 2020.
Yeah. It couldn't be more perfect. So, Jeannie, kind of give us an overview of what kind of 10-minute plays we will see this year.
Well, there are, there's always, like always, there's a mix of comedy, and some plays are a little more serious. These plays have a slightly fantastic element because, which is not all, I mean, we usually have at least a couple of plays that are, you know, would fall into fantasy or science fiction. And I think because of the hindsight, we have more of those this particular year. We've got love stories. We've got stories that have, you know, some pain and regret when you're looking backwards. We've got one that's about aliens from another planet objecting to humans infiltrating the universe. They all do this year. It will be 10 minutes. I think they're running very close to the 10 minutes. So if you find that you're watching a play, and this play is not your cup of tea, you only got to sit through 10 minutes.
That's right. That's right. You can turn the page fairly quickly for the next one. That's great. Now, Jeannie, I don't know much about playwriting, but so do playwrights use these 10-minute plays sometimes as like a soup starter for something that will grow into a full play someday, or do these just exist on their own?
I think that it can go either way. I know for myself, the very first play I had done at the Boston Marathon stood on its own, but it just kept bugging me, and there was more going on there, and it eventually led to a full-length play. I think other plays are just, that's what they are. They're 10 minutes. They're a story. They're like a short story.
Right. And so I should tell listeners that both Kim and Jeannie do have a 10-minute play in this year's 10 Fest. So I'm going to ask each of you, starting with you, Kim, to tell us about the play that you wrote that's in this year's Fest.
Sure. I think I have a longer title than the play. and people have been abbreviating the title to How to Extirpate, and people have learned what the word extirpate means. How to extirpate human population from your planetary preserve. So I'm the guilty party who wrote about aliens who are not so happy with human beings being in their space, and they're trying to figure out how to get rid of them. And that was kind of influenced by me working for the Nature Conservancy for many years. I took it a little different direction than they would have, but yeah. So it's a fun comedy. I think people will like it.
I just want to make sure, Kim, during 2020, a lot of strange things happened. Did you have any alien interaction last year?
No. It would have been something interesting without a lockdown. But no.
We would have welcomed a little alien interaction last year.
Exactly, yeah.
And Jeannie, tell us about your 10-minute play.
My play is called The Grand Reality, and that is a term that is fairly prevalent in alternate theories, alternate universe theory. And it is about how the choices we make in life are important.
And Kim, what is it that you enjoy about 10 Fest?
I think Jeannie hit the nail on the head. Whether you're producing, directing, writing a play or in it, or just watching them, you don't like the weather, wait 10 minutes. It's so fun, and it's a group of people, many of whom who've done 10 Fest every year since we started. And we welcome new people. We love to, you know, showcase. Most of the time, there's somebody who's never had a play on stage or who's at least never produced with us. And so it helps us to meet new playwrights and support them.
Jeannie, let's give people details about 10 Fest, where it will be held, when, and how they get tickets.
It begins on Thursday, August 12th, Friday, August 13th, and Saturday, August 14th, and all of those performances are at 7:30 p.m. We then have a Sunday matinee, August 15th, and that's at 2 p.m. And tickets are $12 for and 10, 12 for ordinary folk and 10 for seniors and students. And if for reservations, you can email the, I'm going to let Kim tell you.
All right. Sounds good.
You can do, you can call the Valley Players at 802-583-1674 and leave a reservation there. Or you can email us at vtplaywrightcircle@gmail.com, and playwright is written just like a boat right. It's W-R-I-G-H-T-S. So probably you'll call after hearing this on the radio. But you can also go to vtplays.com, which is easier to spell.
That's right.
To get all this information.
All right. Vtplays.com is probably the easiest place to get that. But I'll give that number one more time for Valley Players to make reservations, 583-1674. Now, Kim, you hold monthly workshops, and what are covered in these? Who can attend?
Anybody can attend. If you're an audience member who likes to hear new work, we always welcome actors or people who are willing to read and have fun reading something out loud. And if you're a playwright, just let us know that you're interested. We take up to 20 pages from a person a month so that we can fit in 3 people. And you can always sign up for our newsletter on our website. That'll tell you, you know, we send something out every month.
Jeannie, what is it that you enjoy about participating in these workshops?
Just checking in. It's like a reality check once a month in that even if I don't have something to read, it gives me both pleasure and inspiration to hear what other people are writing about and what other people are thinking about. There's always something surprising, and it's a good group of people. It's been odd. It works pretty well on Zoom. I mean, I'm sick of Zoom like most people, but in person, I don't know. You get to hear your words, or you get to hear someone else. You get to help someone else hear their words.
And we've got about a minute left, but Kim, what skills does it take to be a playwright compared to other forms of creative writing?
I think the biggest thing to remember about plays is it's dialogue. It's people are going to listen to people interacting with each other. And yeah, there may be some action, but really it's no holds barred. You can write whatever is most important to you, but it's going to be seen and heard, and people are going to embody that work.
All right. I'll give the phone number again and the email address if you're interested in 10 Fest, which is next Thursday through Sunday. Phone number is 583-1674, and where you can email vtplaywrightscircle@gmail.com. Kim Ward is the founder and vice president of the Vermont Playwrights Circle. Jeannie Beckwith is a playwright, the founder of 10 Fest, and she's the director of the Playwrights Circle's board. I want to thank you both for being on the program this morning.
Thank you for having us.
All right, take care. We'll get a CBS News update, and then we're going to talk to Vermont State Police Sergeant Jay Riggin about boating sober. And coming up today at 1 o'clock on WDEV, we've got the full 3 hours of The Getaway with Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. Getting out on the water in a boat with the amazing summer sun and a close group of friends can be heady and feel like a festive get-together, a party-like atmosphere. But driving a boat is still driving, and maybe even more complicated than driving a car when you consider that all the roads are unmarked and are intersecting at all times, and the weather can play a vital and unpredictable part in operating your craft. So impaired boating can lead to some serious dangers. That's why we've invited Vermont State Police Sergeant Jay Riggin on the program this morning to discuss the potential for problems when mixing alcohol and operating a boat. Sergeant Riggin, thanks for being on Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. Listeners, if you've got questions for Sergeant Riggin, the numbers here are 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Sergeant Riggin, how does Vermont compare to other states in terms of boating fatalities?
When comparing Vermont to other states with boating fatalities, we average about 10.5 incidents per 100,000 registered vessels, and that's compared to a national average of just under 6 incidents per 100,000 vessels. So perhaps, you know, when we think of it on that scale, we're slightly above the national average, but when we actually drill down into Vermont numbers, I think we do okay here. And when I say okay with that kind of inflection in my voice, what I mean is isn't one boating-related fatality or injury or incident, you know, too many. I don't like to think of it as, well, do we have a problem when we get to 10 deaths, or do we have a problem when we get to 20 deaths?
Yeah.
You know, we're on the road to zero here, and that's what we're seeking to do.
Do we know how many of these deaths can be attributed to alcohol use by a person driving a boat?
So think nationally for a second, and then mm-hmm. and then look at Vermont. Is the National Association of State Voting Law Administrators tells us that when alcohol is a known factor in a crash, so I think sometimes it's not known because bodies aren't recovered following an incident, but when alcohol is known as a factor, it's about 23% of boating-related incidents have an alcohol factor. In Vermont, I think it's more complicated to understand the scope of the issue, and I think it's more complicated to understand the scope because we have our own boating law administrator. His name is Sergeant Trevor Carbo, a good friend of mine. He works in our special operations unit with the state police. He's the one who would collect the data that needs to be reported to him. And in speaking with Sergeant Carbo, he really only gets notified when deaths occur versus all incidents generally. And so from January 1st of 2019 to today, to him, he's received a report of 15 incidents, and 10 of those involved fatal incidents. Five of them were non-fatal. So we just think about that for a second. We can talk about, you know, the drug and alcohol nexus, but just think about that for a second. From 2019 to today, only 15 incidents were reported to our boating law administrator. And interestingly enough, the gross majority of those happened to be fatal. Only five boating incidents came to him of the non-fatal variety. Mm-hmm. And so if you, you know, for yourself and any of our listeners here, we think about, what does that mean as far as well, I'm on the waterway, whether it's Lake Champlain or Lake Dunsmore or one of our rivers, and I'm aground with my friends and I've had some drinks. The last thing I want to do is report this. You know, I'm going to get my vessel underway and I'm out of here. Mm-hmm. And so our great concern is, you know, are we, do we understand the full scope of the issue here? I don't know that we do. But when we think about Vermont's pivot toward better detection practices, we want to make sure that we're abating our fears that we're missing impaired boaters if we encounter them. To your question about the alcohol nexus here, so we had those 10 fatal incidents in the last couple of years. During those 10 fatal incidents, 14 people died, three of them had alcohol or drugs involved. And so in that way, with the percentages, you know, it's is a smaller percentage. But what we think about is our ability to detect this type of stuff before the tragedy. And the big thing is to educate on this type of stuff before the tragedy.
Now, just so people understand who are operating a boat, is the blood alcohol concentration to be considered boating under the influence the same as the standard used for driving under the influence?
So it certainly is. And in Vermont, there's two prongs of that statute. You know, one is perhaps the commonly considered 0.08 or more. So that's right. 0.08% in our blood for driving a vehicle or operating a vessel. But here's the thing that people don't, I think, appreciate enough on either side of the issue, whether we're on the waterways or the roadways. And that is, if we're operating a vessel or driving a car impaired to the slightest degree, that also is DUI. And I will say that when we talk about the legal limit as 0.08%, that the legal limit is 0.08% because studies show us that by the time the human organism arrives at 0.08, everybody has marked depreciation in their nervous system skills. But on the way to 0.08, a lot of us do become impaired and unsafe to drive. And so it's really important for people to realize that if we feel different, we operate different, and that is DUI or BUI.
To quote some of the ads we've seen, buzz driving, buzz driving is drunk driving. Why is it just as, if not more important, to boat sober than when operating a car?
So it's certainly important to do both of those things sober.
Right, right.
Certainly. However, I think, Rick, that your rundown that you offered at the top of this, the top of the half hour here, was brilliant. Exactly right. It's operating a vessel comes with it, actually, I think, more as complicated as the roadway environment is. Think how the waterway environment is with both the exposure to the sun and the wind that also kind of wears on our nervous system and kind of degrades our tolerances. If you think about the one's comfort operating a vessel, Vermont has a pretty short boating season. I would not put our best boater in Vermont against the best boater in Florida, who boats 12 months a year as far as their comfort level. In operating a vessel, some people are just weekend warriors. They're out there renting a boat for a couple hours, not even having a appreciation, I think, for certainly understanding what the laws are for operation, but the best practices of operating a vessel. So now we're talking about all these things just by its nature is complicated, saying nothing of the fact that with a car I can slam my brakes and maybe I can stop. On a boat, I'm just going to drift, saying nothing of that. Now I'm taking just that variable, and now I'm adding nervous system impairment, whether it's from alcohol or other impairing drugs. It can be quite complicated, and when I say complicated, it can be quite devastating.
Yeah, and unlike a car, there's no seat belts. People are walking around on a boat while it's operating, so it's certainly a lot different. And if you happen to hit another boat or hit land, and you're going to send people flying. How are Vermont's waterways patrolled for boating under the influence, Sergeant?
So we have a really good model to be present on all of Vermont's waterways. And so the Vermont State Police has a recreation enforcement team that we just built in the last couple of years. And this was designed to enhance what was historically our auxiliary trooper programs. These were part-time troopers. Some were retired troopers. Some were non-law enforcement, but obtained the level 2 certification. We've supplemented that now with full-time troopers who are out on the boats across the waterways in Vermont. Our fish and wildlife partners, our game warden friends, they have a very large presence on our waterways. The Grand Isle Sheriff's Department, they have a pretty good presence out there off of the islands. And our friends at Colchester Police have a full-time marine unit. Other than that, there may be some little, say, forward-operating police officers who have maybe more informal roles on their own areas of responsibility. But the departments I just recognize are pretty well dispersed throughout the state. And we seek to be as present as possible and as non-adversarial as possible, because we really do in our hearts believe that if we're going to achieve, say, a zero on the statute when it comes to deaths or serious injuries, it is by educating the public. By the time that we're responding and writing a ticket or making an arrest or investigating a crash, God forbid, well, that's just a symptom that the problem has already happened. And therefore, we're addressing the symptom. And we seek to be better than that, which is to enforce on the cause, which is perhaps a education on how people find themselves impaired, why that's dangerous. And by the way, let's avoid that.
Will you pull over or, I guess, stop a boat if it appears to be using excessive speed or sailing erratically?
Absolutely. There are the indicators of impaired boating are really no different than that of a car, which is to say, as our nervous system becomes impaired, often one of the first things that goes is our judgment and our decision-making process. And so therefore, we are engaging greater risk-taking. And so when operating a vessel that is could be as simple as a wake violation, which is either a gross disregard for a wake zone or not recognizing that I'm in a wake zone because of my impairment, and other types of, say, inattentional type operation or risk-taking operation that is directly correlated really now to the injuries and the deaths. Certainly the greater risk that we take, the less safe practices that we engage in, that's where the trouble lives.
And let's go to the phones. We've got Wade joining us from Corinth. Hi, Wade.
Hey, good morning. Good morning. Good morning to your guest. So I just have one two-part question, then maybe another question after that, if you've got time for three.
Sure.
Just like the trading post, limited to three.
All right.
So one, it's unclear. I just haven't been able to find good regulations on overnighting on open water. And is that legal in Vermont?
All right.
The answer is yes, it is. At anchor, you can overnight on a vessel.
Okay, and at anchor, you mean you have to anchor up or do you have to tie up to shore?
Either is appropriate.
Okay, and if you were, then at the second part of that, relating more to what you were talking about, if you were, say, tied up to a tree on a shore and then were on land, is somebody still, I mean, obviously somebody's got to be responsible, but could somebody be ticketed on land, say sitting around a campfire, having a couple craft beers or something, if they were, I guess, would consider the responsible person for that boat, even though it wasn't running or on the open water?
So great question, Wade. This is where the law differs between, say, DUI, this is, car, truck stuff versus boat stuff. which is when one is at anchor, that's considered parked. And so there isn't really this notion of actual physical control like with a vehicle. So if I'm DUIing a car, I'm sitting in a parking lot with the keys of the ignition, the car's idling.
Right.
That could be a DUI arrest. It's not the case with DUI. So once you really put in, they're off the hooks when we talk about DUI stuff. But of course, to what you had kind of alluded to, we certainly don't want to be impaired to the point where we can't be responsible for what goes on with our boat.
Right. We wouldn't do that.
But as far as just like, you know, the good moral compass, for God's sake, but the notion of BUI, once you're at anchor, you're not considered underway anymore.
Mm-hmm, good. And just one more quick question unrelated to that is, is there a minimum, or I should say maximum, horsepower or a thrust rating for a very, very small engine, either a gas engine or thrust rating on an electric trolling motor for like, say, a square back canoe or something where they don't have to be registered?
So that's a really good question. That's outside of my scope of expertise. If you care to leave your information with the station there, I can follow up with you offline, get you an answer. Or you could also reach out to one of the Fish and Wildlife wardens, or give us a call at the State Police in Williston, and I can put you in touch with our rec enforcement team.
All right. Wade, thanks so much for that call and all three questions. Great that you could get those in very quickly. Let's talk about what happens during a boating stop by a marine patrol. Tell us how that unfolds.
So their contact will happen in one of two ways, is what people can pretty much expect, which is safety inspection. If one of our marine patrols sees that there hasn't been a safety inspection done in this boating season, might flag you over or roll up on you. And very, very nicely, very gently have a conversation about if one is open and willing really to the safety inspection idea. We don't necessarily need people's permission for that, but we do like it because, again, this isn't an adversarial process we're engaging in. The second way would be a CA violation, whether there's not a spotter with a tuber or a water skier or a wake violation or speeder or a berthing issue, not giving 200 feet between vessels, things like that. So that'd be a probable cause stop versus an inspection stop. But in either of those scenarios, in fact, I think probably if you're a boater in Vermont and you've voted in Vermont long enough, you certainly have been contacted from that inspection standpoint. Mm-hmm. We try to do as many inspections a year to make sure that everything is up to speed and code on a vessel, not just from an environmental standpoint, but certainly from a safety standpoint. And a lot of people probably have that experience. And then it's during those legitimate contacts that then the marine officer may start to detect or suspect that there's something going on with the operator by way of impairment. Mm. And therefore the investigation would turn in that way to look at that person to see, are they safe to be operating away? The way we look at these contacts is that if one is going to leave that contact with that marine officer, it's because they will have literally received that sticker of approval. And you think about the people on the vessel, they've gotten that figurative stamp of approval from the officer, which is that you are a safe vessel and you are safe to operate away from here, which is to say that you're not impaired. Because we don't want to put something into motion for what happens next that could be devastating by way of a crash. So when we contact you, it's a way to both think about the vessel safety, but also the operator safety as well. And some of those encounters do end with the tour being done for the day. Because life vests, there's not one for every serviceable life vest for everyone on board, mm-hmm. or there's an impairment issue where now we've taken people into custody, which we don't want to do, but we will when it's an avoidance of a tragedy.
Are boaters required to pass any kind of operator's exam or proficiency before being able to use a boat in Vermont?
So those born after a certain year, I believe it's 1977, are required to have taken a Vermont boater safety course. That's really an online experience now, which makes it very accessible in that way. There are also in non-COVID times in-person programs for that, for those who don't have internet accessibility. But that is a requirement for people to operate a boat on Vermont's waterways.
Let's try to sneak in one more call. Fred's calling from Newbury. Fred, hi. Go right ahead.
I think it was around in the late 50s, early 60s, my folks had a place on a small pond. I had a 10-horsepower aluminum boat, and my friend had a 25-horsepower wooden boat. And we used to go out and play fighter pilot, and the guy that could get behind the other guy would win. So we'd go in, and we'd be making circles around the lake. And because my turn rate was a lot faster than his, I could get inside of him, and he'd be forced on the outside. And then I could get back and into his wake and win every time. We had more fun doing that. There was a guy across the lake. He used to come out of his dock and watch it.
Fred, I can only hope that that was being conducted soberly by both of you, but thanks for that tale. Before we have a couple minutes left, Sergeant, and I do want to make sure we talk about any other boating safety issues that operators should be aware of and well-versed in.
So one thing that our friend and partner, Colchester Marine Officer Steve Gutierrez, he's a corporal over there, a great guy. His passion point is it's not just simply being knowing your vessel and being comfortable with the laws and so forth and knowledgeable of the laws, but know the waterways that you're operating on. There's the charts and so forth that people may use are good, but boy, you don't have to be on Lake Champlain very long to see that there's unmarked reefs, saying nothing of just debris that may come in from the new ski and so forth. So it's really important to know where the danger zones are so that we don't find ourselves aground and in distress by a lack of that knowledge. So knowing your waterways, I think, is a really one. I think people underestimate that. Open water does not mean that just beneath the surface is a reef or an obstruction.
How has the boating season been so far this year?
So it's been pleasant as far as people we've encountered. Everyone's been in good spirits. From an incident standpoint, you know, we have sadly had a double drowning incident from 2 weeks ago. There was a drowning incident before that gentleman on a sailboat. So it hasn't been fatal free, and that always kind of leaves a sadness and a pallor kind of over the environment. But I think I want to emphasize that we absolutely respect and appreciate that the huge majority of boaters are out there doing the right thing, being safe, being responsible. And it's our goal, our great desire to identify the gross minority of boaters who are endangering the collective and to simply make sure that everyone who's up here, whether we're on a holiday or whether we're on a recreation time with our families, make sure that everyone leaves with everyone they came with. Because when people arrive in Vermont on a holiday and they leave with one less person in their vehicle because of a tragedy, just know that your troopers and your Marine officers are out there to make sure that that everything stays on the joyous side of celebration and not the other.
Sergeant Jay Riggin serves on the Vermont State Police Traffic Safety Unit. You can learn more at vsp.vermont.gov. And Sergeant Riggin, I want to thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Thanks so much for the time. Great to hear from you and the callers.
All right, take care. It's a travel day for the Sox. They head to Detroit, so you can hear the afternoon news service from 4 to 5:30 today. That's followed by the Brady Farkas Show up until 7 tonight. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Every athlete has been taught the importance of stretching before performing. And think about that last trip to a major league ballpark. Trainers are out on the field helping the pros stretch before a game. So you know there's some value in stretching, but what exactly might not be clear to you? And why do athletes have someone help them stretch beyond what they themselves are capable of doing? Let's get some answers from Maggie Mae Anderson, who is about to open Stowe Stretching Studio. Maggie Mae, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks so much. I'm happy to be here.
It's great to have you. Listeners, if you have questions about stretching or about Maggie Mae Anderson's new studio, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Maggie Mae, start by giving us an idea of your background in yoga and massage and fitness.
Lovely. Well, I've been teaching yoga since 2001, and to be sincere, my father bought me my first book of yoga when I was 13, And I don't even know why he bought me this book. It was way beyond my comprehension. It was half in Sanskrit. It was like a seminal book of yoga. It's called Light on Yoga by B.K.S. Iyengar. And I couldn't really read the text, but I could follow the pictures. Mm. And at 13, I just fell in love with, hey, I'm kind of bendy. I can do this stuff. And then I got older. I went to massage school when I was 25. And my massage school, actually, I became a certified holistic health practitioner. So it was more than massage. It was nutrition. It was yoga. It was Tai Chi. And I had an amazing teacher then. And just really, for my own self, I'm a recreational triathlete when I was younger. I've always been really active, and yoga was just this really important part of not only my physical health, but yoga and the whole branch of it, the mental and emotional part as well.
I love how your father knew at 13, this is the right thing to give to this child right now.
Pretty spot on.
Yeah, they can spot it in you. And what is it about these areas that you've really enjoyed and for yourself and with working with people?
Well, I'm totally a people person, and I always knew I wanted to do, even when I was younger, I wanted to do something that I could feel like I was in service, I was being helpful. Massage was a really natural, like, that just naturally came to me. Mm-hmm. And same thing with yoga. And now that my life is in a little bit of a transition, I still want to be of help and of service. And it seems like whether you're an athlete or whether you're older and you're having a hard time moving because of aging, whether you're injured, this is still a way I can work with people one-on-one and feel like I'm being helpful.
And you are kind of segueing out of massage. Why is that?
I am. Well, after 21 years, and I love all my clients, it's just been hard on my body. I've specialized in deep tissue and neuromuscular, and I'm just like, I would like to open up a peanut butter jar when I'm 65. And I think if I stop massaging full-time now, I might be able to do that.
That's interesting. You know, when we get the massage, we are just thinking, oh, how wonderful this is. I have this person who gives me this great massage. But you don't really think about what they are experiencing, the physical kind of stress that the massage, the person administering the massage is giving. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, wow. No. And that's, I mean, classically, most massage therapists only work full time about 5.5 years. I've done it for 21. I've definitely filled my quota. I love my clients, but I've just got to figure out another way to move on.
All right. I think that's acceptable.
Yeah, thank you.
Now, you're moving on from massage. Was stretch your first idea for post-massage direction for your life?
Well, to be sincere, I was hoping to go to graduate school to be a clinical mental health counselor, but that just didn't pan out in terms of finances. Mm-hmm. And then I have an amazing client who's one of my very closest friends who she herself was like, hey, these stretch studios are popping up all over L.A., Boston, New York. There's not one in Stowe yet. So she planted the seed in my head.
Wow. So this is something that is happening around the country right now that we
are
a little bit behind on.
Classic of Vermont.
Yeah.
I kind of love that about this state.
Right.
Yes.
All right. When do you actually open? When do you launch?
Today!
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
All right. So you have clients lined up, like, after we get off the air today?
I do. I have my first client at 2:30 today.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I'm really excited.
Well, congratulations. Yeah. This is really exciting.
It really is.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. So what exactly do you do when a client comes in for a stretch session?
That is the most popular question. Like, what exactly are you offering, Megan?
Yeah. I mentioned this to you before we went on, but this morning when we were talking about it on the air, Craig said, what stretching? Are they putting people on the rack? What is going on? It's not that.
It is not the rack. Okay. There's no apparatus involved other than myself and your body.
Good.
Yes.
Good.
So depending on the person and their level of flexibility, well, first they're going to come in. I'm going to do an assessment, ask like what you've been up to, like what kind of movement, what kind of injury, kind of assess how flexible you are. And then some people will lie on the massage table and I actively like, I pick up your leg and stretch your hamstrings. I do range of motion on your hip. I roll you over and stretch your back. It really is a very passive thing for the person. And kind of the nickname is yoga for lazy people. Mm. I will be the one picking up your arm, your legs, put you on your back, pull you up to stretch your back, your neck. So I passively stretch your body.
Okay, so yes. I would guess then that all these are solo sessions.
Yes.
Since you're doing that. And then how long do they last?
Well, the first initial treatment, because I need to do an assessment on you and get a little bit more history, is an hour, which is about 10, 15 minutes of assessment and talking, and then about 40 to 45 minutes of stretching. after that first one, I'm hoping people want to come because the more you stretch, the better you feel.
All right.
Regularly. And those ones are 45 minutes and just like probably a 5 minute. So how you been since last week or 2 weeks? And then lie down and I stretch you out.
Now, you're moving from yoga and massage, which you've done. You'll still do some of that.
I'm offering four things at the studio.
Okay.
So I'm offering the stretch sessions, which are kind of like the core of things. I'm offering Thai massage. So Thai massage is still massage, but it's you're wearing clothes, you're on a mat on the ground. It's assisted stretching plus thumb and palm pressure along certain lines of your body. So if somebody's still itching to get kind of a massage, I'm still offering that, but Thai massage.
Okay.
And yoga's been a passion of mine since I was 13. So I'm still doing private yoga. And then there's also restorative yoga, which is props and blankets and bolsters, and you lie over the props in a very relaxing position for about 10 minutes, and then I actually come, and again, the massage is still tied in here. When you're in the restorative position, I rub your feet or your hands or your head. I'm offering that as well.
Now, I know you're not much older than 13 now, but you still had to be one of like the first people in the country who was into yoga, you know.
Oh, come on. Yoga was all the rage in the 70s.
Was it?
I was, especially in California.
All right, yeah.
Yes.
I lived in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Yogi Bear was what we knew. Yoga was, something you might have heard someone mention. But
and
it
I do hear it's only gotten more and more popular.
Yes,
yeah.
It has in the last 15,
like
20 years.
Yes.
Right, okay. Now, let's get back to stretching. How do you train to be a stretch practitioner?
I love that. Like, I'm out stretching on all my spare time.
Yeah.
Well, between the way I've trained specifically is I've – not only am I a yoga teacher, I'm also considered a yoga therapist. So the base level of yoga training is a 200-hour training, and I've gone to the 1,000-hour mark. So it's just a whole other level of training. So I really just invested years to get the 1,000 hours in. And not only know stretching, but really know the anatomy and know how things are connected and be a little bit more familiar with different, like if you're a ballerina versus someone who's elderly versus a baseball player, what muscles would need more attention.
Right.
Yes.
Wow. All right. So your studio opens. Is it a studio or do you go to?
It's an office space. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm calling it this alliteration, right? SSS, Stowe Stretching Studio, but I'm sharing an office space in Stowe.
But people would come to the studio or do you go to homes and do this if someone wanted that?
People, I mean, I would consider that. I did that with massage for 20 years.
Right.
And that did get a little bit of running around. So I'm hoping people will just come to me.
Right.
But I'm definitely open. Like if you're elderly and you can't make it to my office, I will totally come to you.
All right.
Yeah.
And you're already booking clients. So how does someone get in touch with you and who's interested now in having this passive stretching?
Well, there is. My email is stowstretchingstudio@gmail.com.
All right.
And then I'm a little behind. My website will be up soon. But you can wait for it. The website is stowstretchingstudio.com.
Okay.
And my phone number as well.
All right.
805-595-5925.
Good number.
Yeah, unless you're dyslexic. It was a little tricky for me at first. I was actually giving out wrong. Yeah.
Well, it's always tough when you get that new phone number, or every once in a while you'll flip back to like an old phone number. Like, wait, that's not my number.
Yeah, or you mix them together. Yeah.
Yeah. My mom had the same phone number in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania for, I don't know, 60, 70 years. It was 866-4000. Great number for a business. So it was just the house. Many wrong numbers, but thinking it was like a doctor's office or a restaurant. But
interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Maggie May, what is a good stretch? What is that? What is that? Comprised of?
It comprises of a little bit of patience. well, in general, a lot of times people, especially, we tend to focus on cardio or strength.
Right.
And then stretching is like this like afterthought thing of like, oh, I'll just like take a few seconds here and I'll lean over, I'll put my leg against a wall and stretch. And what we are now learning as there's more and more research is that the longer you hold it for some things, the much better, especially things like your hamstrings, these big muscles in the back of your legs.
Right.
So a good stretch is one where you're a little bit warm, where you're not just coming out of the supping cold, and where you take your time. You don't like push to your max degree immediately, and then you kind of work your way into it, and then you just hold it and breathe. The other important part, which I think sometimes in this stretching world of mine, I'm a breath coach as much as I am a stretching a facilitator.
Yeah, yeah.
Just reminding people like, okay, we're going to hold this for probably a minute and a half, and you need to take long, deep breaths. And especially the more that you exhale, the more your body knows that's your body signal that you can rest and digest that whole exhale. So you hold it for a while, you're patient with yourself, and you remind yourself to breathe.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I've had a personal trainer in the past, and that is one thing they'll mention to you because you do kind of forget.
Yeah.
Remember to breathe along with what you're doing. Now, how is passive stretching, which is what you're going to be doing at the studio, different from yoga?
It's different from yoga in the fact that someone else like myself is actually doing it for you. So there is a sense of relaxation that is different from actually going to a yoga class, which is another reason why I really was inspired to start this studio. I feel like some people just would not be caught dead in yoga class for whatever reason. They just don't like the group, or they don't want to be seen, this and that. There's something a little bit more relaxing about coming in and knowing that a trained professional is going to actively be holding your limbs. Being like, okay, like I think you can go a little bit farther. Take a deep breath with me. Here we go. So it's a bit more of a relaxing, like being taken care of feeling versus going to a class.
But getting similar benefits.
Oh, very much so. Yeah. Yes. Still getting the stretch, still getting the parasympathetic nervous system, the whole rest and digest thing. Yes.
All right. Let's go to Montpelier, and Stephen's joining us. Hi, Stephen. Go right ahead.
Hi, Rick. I was wondering if Maggie might know if there's going to be a class in yoga again at the Montpelier Senior Center.
Anything you know about Maggie?
I am not familiar if that's happening in Montpelier.
All right.
Can't say.
Stephen, that's something I might have to research for you, but unfortunately Maggie doesn't know the answer to that question. Let's go to Michelle, who's joining us. Hi, Michelle. Go right ahead.
Anything you know about
Maggie? Hello. Hi, Michelle. You might want to turn your radio down.
Okay, just let me do
that. All right.
Because I'm listening to Maggie. So. Okay, here we go.
Okay. Go ahead, Michelle.
Yes.
Hello?
Hi, Michelle. You probably want to turn your radio off and just listen through your phone.
Okay, let me do that.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, done.
There's that delay that goes on. And,
yes.
Unfortunately, yeah.
Yes, I know. Okay.
Hello.
Hello, Maggie May.
Yes, Michelle.
You know that you've been my massage therapist well over 20 years.
Oh, my.
Yay.
Yay. And the one and only massage therapist I've ever had that's been so intuitive into where to help people, where to massage, how deep to massage, and everything else. She's the best. And I, now that I've had a few joints replaced, et cetera, and I can no longer do any exercise other than water aerobics, I am looking forward to being stretched by Maggie in her stretching studio.
Oh, yeah. What a perfect segue, Michelle, for you after 20 years of massage from Maggie May, now to have this service. That sounds great.
It's absolutely. I can't wait. I'm looking forward. She and I had dinner last night, and I'm booking an appointment today.
Oh, that's fantastic. All right.
In addition to being a therapist, she's become a very good friend.
I understand that. All right.
Michelle,
well, thanks
for calling
so much, Michelle. Oh, that's so great to hear. Boy, that it must be really gratifying when, you know, you've heard from clients who you've had for years about the work you do.
Oh, my gosh. That's one of the reasons why I massage for so long. You become part of people's families.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the benefits of stretching in general. You know, we talk about it in like warming up to go out and do a physical activity. But, you know, how about for, you know, someone who's not very active, you know, at work all day, sitting at a desk, you know, why would they come to you for this stretching?
I love that you're asking that because I even have that on what's going to be my website about this is for the triathlete and the desk jockey.
Right.
Like, no matter what, because whether you're super active or not active, both things create tightness in your body. Whether you're sitting at a desk all day, especially now since the pandemic,
right.
I actually almost daily send my sister a text because now she only works from home. Have you stood up yet today? Have you stretched yet today? Like, I'm always reminding her to get up. So if you're someone who is more sedentary because of an injury or because of lifestyle or because of how you work, no matter what, we all get tight. We all have tension in our shoulders. We can get sore in our low backs. And stretching, especially assisted stretching, helps to increase both flexibility and range of motion. And there's actually some new research nowadays that thinks that assisted stretching can actually help stimulate muscle growth. So it could actually help you recover from things. Yeah. So it's so good to be stretched to help get that. And also, no matter if you're more sedentary or more active, either way, there's something repetitive. Maybe the way you're seated, shoulders forward at the computer, that's very repetitive. Maybe you're an avid runner. That's a very repetitive motion. Stretching helps to like remind the body there's other ways to move. You don't get stuck in that pattern.
Mm-hmm.
There's this thing that covers all of our muscles called fascia. It's connective tissue. And your fascia is very prone to getting like grooved. And then that makes you stuck in your groove. So when we stretch and we do range of motion, you're reminding your body that, oh, no, you can move in a different way. You're not stuck in this position.
Right.
It just gives you more flexibility, more ease, and the ability to relieve tension, to get the tightness out.
Wow. And so like massage, when you go to massage therapists, they usually ask, you know, is there a certain part that's, you know, bothering you? You can kind of feel where there's a knot.
Mm-hmm.
But will you do that with stretching as well, where someone, you know, needs specific attention to certain parts of their body?
Oh, yeah. And that's why there's always going to be an assessment involved. And also, I was a triathlete, I said earlier. I'm a swimmer. I'm a hiker. I'm a biker. I'm a cross-country skier. And it's good. I can relate. And also, to be sincere, I've had almost every injury known to man. Like, I'm actually recovering from ankle surgery. So whoever comes to me, I feel like – when someone tells me there's a swimmer, I'm going to focus more on their neck and their shoulders, right? When someone comes and tells me they're a runner, I'm going to focus more on their hips and their legs. And when someone tells me I've had this injury, I'm going to say, me too, and be able to tailor it. And that's the other thing that I've always loved working with people one-on-one in these ways because it gets to be so specific, which is another thing that makes it, even though I still love teaching yoga, when you come to a yoga class – it is – you just have to do what the teacher says. It's not tailored to your body. And now when you come to me, this is 100% tailored to, oh, you're a swimmer who one time fell off a horse and then your knees hasn't been the same since. Here's what we could do for your body and those injuries.
Very interesting. Now, will you be able to – people who come to you, will you – you know, kind of – I don't know if I want to say homework or assignments, but will there be stretching that they can go and do once leave you so that, again, when they come, each time they're a little bit looser,
longer,
feeling
less tension. That's completely the plan. So we work together. I figure out what you've been up to, what kind of injuries you've had. I do the whole stretch session and then send you home with things. And it's like at-home practices if you want them. In all honesty, if people do them, they'll make coming back to me a little bit easier.
Right.
But yeah, I definitely – it is also that sense of I want to empower people. I want them to understand their own bodies better, understand their own muscles better, and know how to take care of themselves better. I just want to facilitate health. Yes.
All right. Now, let's mention again, you mentioned this earlier, the other services in addition to stretching that you'll be offering at the Stowe Studio, the Stowe Stretching Studio.
Lovely.
Yeah.
So I'm offering Thai massage. And if you're not familiar, I had so much fun. I actually went to Thailand for a month to study.
Oh, my.
So you would come in dressed like you're going to take a yoga class. So you're in loose, stretchy clothing. And then depending on your body type, either on the table or, again, on this big cushy mat on the floor. And it is assisted stretching and range of motion. So like I'll lift up your legs, I'll stretch your arms, I'll stretch your neck, I'll do range of motion on your shoulders and your hips. But then it's also still massage in the fact that it isn't like massage with oil, but it is palm and hand pressure up your – like the back of your legs or down your back or along the top of your chest. So you're still getting that pressure of massage and the stretch and range of motion. So for some people who still want body work and need a stretch – Thai massage is the way to go. And then I'm still offering because, again, it's like my passion. So come on in, and I will do that in couples, one or two people, and let's tailor a yoga class specifically for you and your body. And I love newbies, people who maybe don't want to go to a class because they are intimidated. Come to me. It's this beautiful private room. You can be a complete newbie, know none of the language, not even know what a down dog is, and come, let's work together. Or maybe you're more advanced and just want a more challenging thing. Mm. I love tailoring it right to the person or the couple. And then restorative yoga is one of my favorite things because it's so relaxing and people love it. And I just love, it's kind of more creative. So I have bolsters and blankets and blocks. And again, I try to figure out like, oh, you've been seated a bunch in front of a computer. Your shoulders are probably hunched. So we're going to put the blocks and blankets so that you're actually leaning back and over and your shoulders are opening. Mm. And while you're there and I coach you to breathe, then I massage your feet while you're there. It's a very relaxing experience.
Maggie Mae Anderson is the owner of Stowe Stretching Studio, and the number is 595-5925. And what's the email address?
StowStretchingStudio@gmail.com.
All right. I want to thank you so much for being on with us this
morning.
Thank
you so much for having me.
We're going to take a break, and then we're going to hear the details of the renewable energy project that's powering Middlebury College, an anaerobic digester. And coming up today at 11 o'clock, we have Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Powering the planet with something other than fossil fuels is going to come in many different varieties. And a couple weeks ago, Middlebury College took another step toward its renewable energy future with the opening of the state's largest anaerobic digester located at the Goodrich Family Farm in Salisbury. Here to tell us about how it works and what this means for the college's future is the school's Dean of Environmental Affairs and Sustainability, Jack Byrne. Jack, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, Rick. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And John Hanselman is with us. He's founder and CEO of Vanguard Renewables, which built this anaerobic digester. John, great to have you with us this morning.
Rick, glad to be here.
Thanks. Now, listeners, to ask our guests about the digester and how this helps the state's energy needs, you can give us a call at 244-1777, 877-291-8255, or you can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Jack, what is Middlebury College's overall renewable energy plan?
Rick, we're in pursuit of four different goals. The digester is relevant to the first one, which is to get to 100% renewable sources of energy by 2028. The other three are to cut our consumption of energy by 25% by 2028 and to divest our endowment from fossil fuels on a slightly different schedule than 2028, but to have most of it done by then. And then finally, just to wrap all that into the educational mission of the college and make sure that opportunities for research and student projects are something that we take advantage of as we pursue these goals.
John, I've used the term quite a bit, but I'm not sure I even know what I'm talking about. What is an anaerobic digester?
It's a really good question, Rick. I think most people aren't particularly familiar. It's a technology that was developed in Europe probably 25 years ago and is actually widely deployed all over Europe and the United Kingdom. You can think of it the most easily as a 2 million gallon hot pot. So we take food waste and animal manure, combine the two of them in these huge tanks. We heat them up and we kind of set the timer for 30 days. And the naturally occurring little microorganisms that are in the gut flora of the cow that come through the manure actually eat the food waste and emit methane. And methane is natural gas. We then dry that and pressurize it and inject it into the VGS gas line as renewable natural gas. So a totally renewable form of natural gas is one of the byproducts. The other thing that we get is this fantastic organic fertilizer. So once we've taken the gas out of the food waste and manure slurry, we have this really outstanding organic fertilizer, which we give back to the farm and allow all of those nutrients, the wonderful food waste nutrients that would otherwise end up in a landfill and being leached out into the waterways. We actually get to put that back onto the farm and return those nutrients back to the soil.
So even with going through this process and removing the methane, the manure still has great nutrients for the land?
The manure has some nutrients. It's actually the food waste that adds the most of the great. I mean, it's one of those incredibly cool stories that we really didn't understand when we started the business, is that food waste, you know, it has gas in it, but then has a lot of nutrients, and those nutrients should be going back to the soil. And in most of the U.S., they're ending up in landfills or incinerators. And so it's a tragic loss. It's great to be able to kind of get that stuff back to the soil and really create some carbon health in that soil.
Jack, what did it mean to the college when you were able to throw the switch or whatever happens to get a digester running a couple weeks ago?
Well, it was tremendously satisfying after it was a 12-year odyssey to get to this point. We started working on this project that long ago and hung in there and worked with a variety of partners and came to work closely with Vanguard, who have this incredible technology and experience for running a system like this. And, of course, the Goodriches and Vermont Gas Systems are important partners. So for us, it's almost the crowning piece in getting to this 100% renewable goal. We, back in 2009, switched to wood chips as a primary fuel source from number six fuel oil. So we went from sourcing a lot of our energy from the global fossil fuel supply chain to sourcing it from about a 75-mile radius around the campus. So that's a local renewable source of energy that we're using. And then in addition to that, we were using, natural gas from the Vermont Gas Systems pipeline that comes from Canada and is a fossil fuel source. So now with the digester, we've displaced that fossil fuel gas with this renewable natural gas from the farm. And that puts us about 90% of the way to heating and powering the campus to a certain extent with entirely local renewable fuel sources.
John, how much energy will the digester at the Goodrich Family Farm generate?
It's pretty exciting. So our digester at the Goodrich Farm produces enough energy to heat and provide the cooking fuel for over 5,000 homes. So it's quite a lot of natural gas.
So is that in excess of what Middlebury College would consume?
Yes. Yeah. So Middlebury will at peak, will probably take about just a little over half of what we produce.
Wow.
And the remainder we're sending back into the VGS system, and it's going to be made available for residential customers and commercial customers to decarbonize their footprint.
Jack, give us a little background on the Goodrich Family Farm.
It's about a 900 milking head dairy farm. I believe they have somewhere in the range of a couple thousand acres that they farm. They have been just very tenacious in their commitment to being a Vermont family farm and being able to pass that farm enterprise on to their children and grandchildren. So this project was really important to them for the benefits it provides. They're getting their manure managed more effectively. They receive bedding from the process of the digester. they get lease payments for the use of their land for the digester. So, you know, it's really satisfying to be able to partner in a project like this that you know, does something really beneficial for an important part of the Vermont landscape and our, you know, our dairy heritage in the state. So it also gives us the opportunity to work with our students to make them aware that when they turn up the thermostat or flip on the light switch in their dormitory rooms, that they're connected to this farm in a way much different than when we were, you know, using fossil fuels from many different places in the world.
Yeah. John, you mentioned it's a 30-day process with the anaerobic digester. So let's talk about that a little bit. Does that mean that all the energy is kind of produced at the end of the 30 days? You know, you have to wait 30 days for more gas to be produced. How does that work?
No, it's a great question. So, Rick, when we start the system up, you know, kind of day one, it's a lot like making sourdough. You kind of put in the starter and you get it going. But once it's going, it's a continuous process. So we feed the digester more food waste every half hour. So we kind of dose it in over the day. And but it continuously makes a gas once you get it up to a steady state.
So, okay. All right. That's really wild. John, I want to talk more about the logistics of the anaerobic digester. Does the energy that's generated at the Goodrich farm get fed to the power grid that offsets what's used by Middlebury? Is it fed to the college? How does that work?
Yeah, it's a good question, Rick. So we actually send all of the molecules, all of the methane molecules, into the Vermont Gas power grid. So it's the actual gas pipeline. Mm-hmm. In effect, there's a pretty good chance, actually, it's the same molecules that leave the farm that will end up powering Middlebury, because our pipe is a straight shot into the Middlebury hub. So for other customers around the state, the molecules will be mixed in with the other Vermont gas. But we're, for the college itself, they actually may actually take a straight feed from the farm, even though it's logistically, we're sending everything right back through the BGS system.
All right. And have you been involved with any other projects that have done this, that have united a local farm with a college or university like this?
No, this is really the first in the nation that we're aware of. We've got five other operating systems in Massachusetts, and we've got another six systems under construction in Colorado, Nevada, and Georgia. But Middlebury really jumped, I think, to the front of the line and is truly leading the nation in how to address their carbon impact. And I think the goals of President Patton and Jack and Dave Provo and all the folks over at Middlebury is just stunning. I mean, it's a really remarkable commitment. And to be clear, without their initial commitment, this project would have taken a lot longer to get done.
Mm-hmm. And as Jack mentioned, 12 years, and we'll talk a little bit about that process. But, Jack, boy, how does it feel for Middlebury College to be out in front on something like this, you know, at a time when this is absolutely necessary for us?
Well, you know, we're incredibly proud of you know, playing such a key role. I think it's a significant opportunity for expanding on homegrown energy. You know, we have a lot of farms and we have a lot of food waste, and we're hoping that, you know, our experience can be shared and others can jumpstart maybe their own systems. I think, you know, there's also a sense that, and we get this from our students, you know, we are in a climate crisis and they are inheriting or have inherited this challenge and this problem that, you know, us older people like myself are in part responsible for. So they want every possible tool they can have in their kit to deal with this. And this is one, but I think we've got a lot more to do. And we have some really significant challenges ahead of us that we're anxious about and excited about figuring out how to tackle.
What is next in the school's renewable energy plan, Jack?
Well, our focus we have two things going on. One, on the electricity side. So, you know, we use this gas that comes from the farm to produce steam and heat the campus. But we also use electricity, and we're at the tail end of a permit process now to put a 5-megawatt solar project in on 30 acres of land that the college owns close to the campus. And when that comes online, that will provide over a third of the electricity that we're using. We generate about 15% of our own energy on campus, and then Green Mountain Power, who have some very aggressive renewable goals for their own production of our distribution of electricity, will help us get to that 100% mark. And then we're paying a lot of attention to our buildings. We've done an inventory. We know which buildings are the least energy performers and which are the best, and we're we're in the midst of an ongoing effort to bring those buildings up to much higher performance standards for their use of energy so that we can get to that 25% goal.
And Jack, you mentioned that getting this anaerobic digester, it was over a decade in the planning. Why did it take so long? And secondly, you know, did you ever lose faith that this might actually occur, that this might be something that would be part of what Middlebury College puts together?
Yeah, well, you can tell we never lost faith, but yeah. It was tested.
Yeah.
It was tested quite a few times along the way. And I think, you know, because we had the college had made a commitment back in 2007 to become carbon neutral and by 2016, so that kept our feet to the fire, so to speak. And you know, we saw this as a really viable, potentially good way to help us get to that goal. You know, it had a previous owner who was able to get through the permit process, but not able to finance the project. So we hung in there, and you know, our role in this is to contract for the gas for a 20-year period. So that gives Vanguard and a customer that they can rely on. So you know, we're happy to have been able to play that role, and you know, we're looking at the next 20 years of this digester as a, not just a source of energy for the college, but a really rich opportunity for research in all kinds of different ways that our students and our faculty and others that are interested could take advantage of.
John, how long did it take to install the digester on site and get it up and running?
Well, and it was, of course, we did all this during the pandemic. Just to make it a little bit stranger, start to finish, probably I think about 18 months, almost 20 months, when we're done, between the time we really broke ground and got gas flowing into the system. It could have been sooner if we could have gotten some of the parts, but there was lots of things kind of stuck in different places around the world that through the pandemic we just couldn't get it to Vermont. But it's overall, the actual construction and startup period, in comparison to the time that it took to kind of get through the process, it was not that terrible.
Yeah. When you look at, you know, how much manure and food waste we would have here in Vermont, and now, you know, we're composting all of our food waste, you know, first of all, are there the materials to keep this digester running? And what's the potential elsewhere throughout the state of Vermont?
Yeah, man. So we take about 180 tons of food waste a day, and we take all of the manure from the farm, which is another 100 tons of manure a day.
Wow.
So it's quite a lot of material that we put into the system. There is more than enough in Vermont to keep our digester, and there are a couple of other digesters in the state, a little bit smaller than ours. But it, really, this goes to letting folks understand that this is a viable pathway. So half of the challenge is just educating people that they can recycle their food waste, and that if they don't recycle their food waste, the carbon impact on it, the climate change impact of sending food waste off, you know, if you just kind of throw it into the bag and don't pay attention and the fact that it's going to landfill,
that's really bad for the environment. And so what we want to make sure everyone understands is that getting it to composting, getting it to an anaerobic digester, either one of those pathways is a significant step up in the way that, food waste can be diverted from making methane and have it openly released into the atmosphere. Because methane, which is the byproduct, and if you just throw your trash and all your food waste into the garbage, it ends up in the landfill. That will break down and release methane. And methane is 25 to 40 times worse than CO2. So it's the most, it's the nastiest greenhouse gas out there and the most corrosive. And if you can divert that and turn it into renewable natural gas, it's like a, it's a double bonus.
Mm. And, you know, one other thing, Jack, that I think about, we've touched on it a little bit, but is, you know, keeping that, the manure, not just the food waste, but the manure, that has caused, you know, runoff into our lakes and streams. Now, you know, putting it into a digester instead of out on the fields or on piles somewhere on a farm.
Well, I think the thing that we didn't mention earlier is that in this process of the digestion that goes on the farm, the phosphorus is actually removed and separated in a dry form so that it can be used much more judiciously and much more effectively for where it's needed, as opposed to going onto the field and, you know, maybe ending up fertilizing areas that don't need phosphorus and then have the potential for that to be run off and carried on down to Lake Champlain from the farm. So that's a significant environmental benefit of this project as well, that, you know, that we're really proud of.
Yeah, it is like the exclamation point on all of this. So I'm glad you brought that up. Jack Byrne is Middlebury College's Dean of Environmental Affairs and Sustainability. John Hanselman is founder and CEO of Vanguard Renewables. I want to thank you both so much for sharing this information today, and congratulations on getting it done.
Thank you, Rick. Pleasure. Great to be here.
All right. Take care. That's our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivergan and produced by Rachel Connor, Zoe Helena, and Brady Jalili. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Feel free to suggest topics or guests, and you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre is up next. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.